I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. One of the important books of the year is the new collection of essays by Jenny Heijoon Wills, Everything and Nothing at All. She writes of herself in the context of the world around her and within her. As a transnational adoptee, she writes of race and ethnicity not only from her perspective, but she looks critically at how others might see her then as now. In her discussions of mental illness, self-harm, queerness, polyamory, and eating disorder, she is frank and honest. Her ability to convey her own feelings, as well as invite the reader to think critically of their own on a variety of subjects, is so necessary in today's culture. Take, for example, how she contends with how she perceived abuse, and how she might have tolerated or rationalized it in the past, and how her view changes because of a myriad of issues like maturing or being a parent. The wisdom brims in the book, and it's more than personal history, but also literary criticism. Her ability to provide cultural context on a variety of issues is often informative and surprising. Jenny Heijoon Wills was born in Seoul, South Korea, and was adopted and raised in a white family in southern Ontario. She wrote about a lot of her experiences in her critically acclaimed and prize-winning Older Sister Not Necessarily Related. It was the recipient of the Hilary Weston Writers' Trust Nonfiction Prize in 2019 and the Manitoba Book Awards Best First Book Prize in 2020. This new book from Knopf is already a 2024 finalist for the Weston Writers' Trust Nonfiction Prize. She is a Fulbright alum, Harvard, and in 2015 was a visiting scholar at Stanford University. She holds two BA honors degrees, an MA, and a PhD. She currently teaches at the University of Winnipeg. We taped this interview in late August with Jenny joining me from Toronto. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Jenny Heijoon Wills. Professor Wills, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. I was just telling you, as we were starting, how I found the book just edifying in that I got what I needed out of it, and even stuff that I didn't think I needed. What's the experience like having written the book? Because it's difficult in a lot of places. It's raw in a lot of places, especially. And now having the book published and talking about it, how are you finding that experience?
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the question, and thanks for this conversation. I'm so excited. You know, I think that there are different stages of me every time I come to a piece of writing, and I've yet to sort of get too much response about how this book is being received, so that nervous side of me still is present.
Uh-huh.
But the process of writing something like this, and especially, as you mentioned, some difficult subjects, is quite technical, actually. I think I was thinking very much about form and voice and style when I was writing this particular collection of essays. And then a lot of the emotion comes in when I'm reading back. And it's when it's in page proof that you can see it in the font, it's going to be consumed in, that I actually start to have a bit of an emotional moment with this work, and it starts to feel a little bit almost I don't know, disassociating in some ways, but it feels validating at the same time, and I'm proud of it.
So I went back and read parts of the book this weekend in preparing for a chat. And I was thinking to myself, you know, there's a lot in here that's personal, and I worry for you in terms of the sort of questions that you'll get from people like myself who will interview about the book. I mean, how are you finding that experience in terms of, say, you know, the unexpected question that you might get from an interviewer, perhaps?
Well, I think maybe if you know something about my life story, which, you know, as a transracial and transnational adoptee, yeah, is like all of these things, very little throws me completely off balance. and I think that adopted individuals, that, as you know, marginalized individuals, people of color and or indigenous people, are quite adept at pivoting around uncomfortable things, I think, in order to survive the spaces in which we find ourselves.
Yeah.
And so I think that while I haven't been asked anything out of pocket, and everyone's been so generous and so kind, I feel somewhat ready, but I also know that if I'm not in that moment, I have the space for myself to forgive myself if I stumble a little bit.
Yeah, for people listening to us, there's a lot in here that you bear that, as someone who's read the book, I mean, there's little that I need to ask you, I guess. You know what I mean? I think the experience of having read the book for people listening to us will be incredibly more satisfying without knowing, without you and me telling them right now what's in it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, thanks for saying that. I hope so.
Yeah. You write about what it was like growing up, and you know, it's an often terrible and difficult time for a lot of people, and it's made more awful because it's in those formative years when, you know, you really need as much support, I guess, as you possibly could. Early in the book, you write that people tolerate abuse from others because it's attention. With hindsight, Jenny, being a parent now, how do you talk to somebody and talk to them out of that notion? I mean, out of that rationalizing or say, ignoring what's bad, say?
Mm-hmm. I mean, don't we all want so much more for our kids than what we experience? I think that that's a really insightful question, that there are a lot of things that I think I was able to accept that I would not accept on behalf of anyone else, especially young people that I care about so deeply. But it's more than, you know, do as I say, not as I do kind of things. It's hopefully creating a space and a foundation and providing kids with, you know, a toolbox of ways of dismantling the things that harm us so that they aren't caught unaware. One of the struggles, as you suggest, that I faced was because I was raised in a transracial context with white parents and in a white community, a lot of the issues that I'm trying to unpack in sections of this text meant that I was dealing with them alone. Mm. And you know, perhaps my Canadian parents could have found resources to help navigate through some of those experiences, but likely they still would have been insufficient. But myself, parenting children of color, myself being a person of color, hopefully parenting in a radically kinned kind of way, hopefully I'm providing the people that I care about with something different. Who's to say if it's better at this point? I'd like to hope that it is.
Mm-hmm.
But at least having those conversations and being aware of the challenges that people could face, I think is, you know, a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as someone who grew up with Filipino parents, who grew up Asian, if you will, that idea of killing the bully with kindness, I mean, that's bullshit, isn't it?
It's gaslighting, first of all, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's sort of victim blamey, but that doesn't really encapsulate what's going on. And it's bearing the weight and the responsibility of treatment on yourself. And it's not dismantling any systemic problems that have caused and allowed and perpetuated those things to occur. So, I mean, I don't personally understand why one would need to stand in a circle of abuse when one should be protected from those things, especially in childhood.
Yeah, I guess there's too many people that think that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But, I mean, that's nonsense too, isn't it?
Right. This narrative of trauma made you stronger is also false, and it's, frankly, like emotionally abusive, I think, in many ways. And, you know, one should never say thank you for harm.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to say that people don't become stronger in the face of trauma, but it's despite those things, and one is maybe able to carve out a way to survive. But again, it's not in thanks to. We should never thank trauma.
There are a couple of instances that I really admire about you in the book where you're a good bystander. For example, you confront people who are obviously doing harm. There's a story in the book about an older, a white person talking to a young Korean girl. And I don't know if you were a customer there or you were working there, but you knew what was happening from the conversation. And you told the girl, you asked the girl if she was uncomfortable, and she said yes. And then you asked her to excuse herself to the bathroom while you looked at this guy. He looked pretty smug at this point. And you told him off is not the right word, but I mean, you gave him a piece of your mind, and mm-hmm. You told him what you were seeing, and he was quite embarrassed by it, wasn't he?
It's interesting the things that people think they aren't being witnessed enacting. In that instance, you know, it was almost as though I was seeing this parallel to so many experiences I'd had in my own youth, and like sort of looking around and feeling discomfort, but not having a name for it or not having a framework to understand why I was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
In this particular scenario, there was an older white man who was clearly flirting on like an underage, new to Canada immigrant Korean girl.
Yeah.
And I wish that there had been people to protect me, but that's also not to say that people should always be sort of imposing themselves in that way, because not everyone needs, you know, so-called saving or intervention.
Yeah. Well, you asked her, didn't you, right? You said, do you feel uncomfortable by all this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that I was so accustomed as an adopted individual of having people watch me from a young age, even not with sort of nefarious intent, mm-hmm. but watch me and try to guess what was going on and guess at my kinship and my experiences. I was so accustomed to, and still am so accustomed to, being surveyed and hyper-visible in society that I couldn't help but notice what was going on in this case. And maybe this girl, who was a stranger to me at the time, didn't realize that she was being noticed and that this man's actions were being noticed. And he certainly was unfamiliar with having been watched in that way.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of a full circle moment, I guess. But one that is a risk because, as you know, also sometimes individuals do not like to be confronted held accountable for their bad behavior, let's just say, and it certainly could have ended differently.
Yeah, it could have gone sideways, and it'd be a different story. I guess we all hope that we have that sort of courage or that gumption to do something when we see something bad happen. It's not funny, but I had to chuckle when you write in another place in the book about remembering being aggrieved by somebody else, and then when you finally work up the courage to confront them, they don't remember that. I mean, that also happens. I don't know if that's gaslighting on their part, but it could very well be. But you know, our memories also play tricks on us, or we you know, especially if you're a bully, you probably don't remember being a bully, right?
Everyone's perspective on those incidents, of course, will be very different. But as we always say in literary criticism, like, the intention of the author doesn't matter. It's the effect of the narrative that is important. And so regardless if someone intended to be bullying, and I'd like to think that I'd hold myself accountable in these ways also, regardless of one's intention, it's the felt material consequences that matter.
You write in this collection about contending with your Korean heritage. You write about how in your growing up, friends would laugh, say, at your inability to speak or know anything about Korean culture. I don't want to give anything away because you worked through all of this in the book. At this point, what do you want of it? And Is there still a part of you that wants to say, I mean, it is a part of you, obviously. Just how much a part of it do you think it'll be of your life from here on out?
Mm-hmm. That you're right. And those moments that I was talking about in those particular scenes, it would be, you know, when I went to college and I'd meet Korean-Canadian individuals who were familiar with all of these things and found it a novelty in some cases, yeah. But I was so unaware of what was going on. You know, it's still important to me. It's still really significant, but I think that I've come to a place where I can accept, and I'm eager to accept, that being an adopted Korean Canadian is my identity, and that I need to let go of this belief that somehow, just as easily as I woke up one day and was in Canada, that someday I'll just wake up and be in Korea in a way that's fully knowable. And so, and it part of it is shifting priorities. I think part of it is the willingness and the confidence to build some sort of new identity and not feel the need to fit into already prescribed categories.
Yeah, that's a tough part, I must say. I mean, I hate to use my own experience, but I mean, you obviously write about this in the book, is that when people interact with you who don't know you or who might have read this book or your memoir and know a little bit about you, have so many conceptions or misconceptions about who you are or who you should be. I mean, there is a moment in the book where you mention a reader of your memoir was quite angry with you because you didn't try hard enough to learn Korean. You know, I guess judging people by how they look, I mean, that's something that I guess we all, we probably feel that more keenly, I guess, than say someone who isn't racialized.
It's possible. I think there are like tons of ways that people can be marginalized and the ways that we feel the weight of expectations and stereotypes, I guess, and narratives can function differently. But I think that for me, maybe it comes from having written that memoir and released some of those explorations in the ways that I did. It comes from just being settled in the place that I am now and trying to build something different as opposed to chasing after something that just wasn't my path.
The essay on reading and books, I found that just exciting to read because it's just fascinating and exciting itself to read about how much a part of that reading and finding books that you needed at a particular time. What that was like for you, because that comes off the page in what you write. There are life choices that come out of reading for you, right? Certain books and the sort.
I think so. I'm so happy to hear you say that because the greatest insecurity that I have is that people will not feel as dorkily obsessed with reading as I am, and that they'll be like, what is this weird chapter? Like, this woman is so strange, and no one else thinks like this kind of thing, but like in a bad way, I guess. So you're right. There were books that have left indelible fingerprints on my life, and it's through books that I try to work through an understanding of race and ethnicity, or at least through books that I started on that journey to give me the confidence to figure something out outside of that. But I'm also just so inspired by the way that people use something like language to communicate all sorts of things. And really that one chapter that you're referencing is a love letter to just some of many, many, many authors and texts that have changed the way that I think about everything. really.
Yeah, I mean, I can't help but think that people read that essay and not get out a pen and paper and find some of these books that you talk about. Like in my context, the Bulosan book is something that I own, but I have not yet picked up. And as soon as I get off the phone with you, I probably will start reading it, because I think as you write, we'll find what we need from these books, won't we? The other thing that essay does for me, and I'm sure it'll do for a lot of readers, is that it'll inspire them to be better readers. Because I think, we like to think, a lot of us like to think we read a lot. But I think we have to read better. You talk in the book about teaching Wuthering Heights to students. And you'll sometimes get complaints from students saying that they've read it already. But you encourage them to reread it, and how do you do that?
In the case of Wuthering Heights, I think it's about drawing their attention to something that, in the case of that book, it's the way that Heathcliff is racialized in the text in very, very subtle ways, in very nuanced ways, and encouraging them to imagine that as fact, and then looking back for other clues in the text. So very active reading. And I think I tried to demonstrate in the essay that follows that chapter on reading, that's an essay about language, but interwoven in this conversation about lost language, stolen language, changing language, is a close reading of Teresa Hakimtaz's novel, Dicte. And so I think I try to model what it could look like, not just to do active reading in the sense of literary criticism like we do in school, but to actually bring a book into a corporeal sense of yourself and let it breathe in your organs and your body and your bones, and how you can really live in alongside a book.
Yeah, I think we overlook that sometimes, because, I mean, a lot of us have to read for work, say, or we have to read, you know, or we're reading a book because it's on the bestseller list and everyone else is reading it. But at the end of the day, it is a very personal experience reading, a solitary experience, and it does shape one's life in a way that we don't expect sometimes.
Absolutely. I feel like one of the most intimate things that one can share with, you know, another person, which is reading their text or them having read your text. And it's so funny that we phrase it like that. And I do the same thing. Oh, I have to read this for class. I have to read this for X, Y, Z. But haven't we chosen these paths because we love to read? But it strikes me that I do find myself saying that as well. And it saddens me a little bit. But, of course, time is such an unforgiving thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Has your relationship to certain books, has that changed? I mean, I'm curious to know, let's say you really like a book and you admire it or it's meant a great deal. On subsequent readings, have you found that diminished, say?
Not diminished, always augmented. Always changed, and I feel that every time you read a book, it becomes a new text. And in fact, on the cover page of every book that I read, I write my family name, and then I also write the year. And so some books, like Beloved, like Their Eyes Were Watching God, like Dicte, like Rue, there will be a list of dates on that cover page, because I want to also have as part of that, I guess, archive on that version of the book, the number of times I've spent with that text and the number of versions of that text I've read, because it will always be different, because I'll be in a different mood, I'll be in a different chair, I'll be in a different decade of my life, and it's a new thing that time. And I want to have those kinds of records when I look back at my library.
Yeah, that's important. When I know when I buy a book, I put down the year that I bought it, and then I hate myself later when I realize it's been several years since I actually started reading it after I bought it. You know, But
oh boy.
I think it's a great way to track down your life. I mean, I also write down what city I bought it in, or because I think, you know, I'd like to remember, yeah, I was on vacation, and I walked into that bookstore, and I bought that book that day.
That's a great idea. I'm going to add that to my process. I'm going to write down where I am each time I read.
Yeah, I did.
I love that.
And then you remember, like, I read your book, your publisher sent me a Galleys, but, so, you know, I liked reading it, you know, how holding it in my hand, because I remember places, like, I remember that it was on the left side of the page or the bottom right, when I read something from your book as I was making my notes, you know. By the way, in the publication of Everything and Nothing at All, did you have a say as to what paper or ink was used by Knopf?
That is so funny you should ask that, because in my mind, as we were just talking, I was thinking about how sometimes I order books for class from certain publishers because I like the way the ink smells. I am like, I'm just like all over books. It's like so, it's like maybe like TMI, or like not appropriate for work. I'm just like, I'm just consuming them in such a sort of multi-imagistic way, I guess. I did not have any sort of influence, let's say, on the paper or the font. I think it's beautiful, the book that was produced in design here, alongside the cover and all of those things. I'm just always in awe that such talented, brilliant people would even spend a second of their time with my work. So it's just, but no, I was not influential in any way. That way.
I've noticed with the books have gotten lighter over the last 30 years. And the other thing is, because I do sign my name on the fly leaf, I do notice what paper is used, because, you know, I use a fountain pen, and the ink bleeds differently on certain kinds of paper. And
what can you tell me about this one then?
You know, I haven't signed this yet, because I usually don't sign it until I finish the interview, but... actually, let's do that right now. Well, see, I've got a galley.
You have the galley, right?
Yeah, I have the finished copy. It's behind me on my other desk.
Okay.
But I'll send you a note. How's that?
Okay, I love that. I love that.
So in that essay about writing and the relationship you have with books and special books, especially in your life, what is it like when readers come up to tell you how much your memoir meant to them, or how it changed their life? I mean, have you had people come up to you and tell you that? Because I'm sure you have. You know, I'm just assuming you have had.
Yeah, it is possibly the kindest gift and the bravest thing maybe to do, because I don't know if I have the courage to do that myself. It is one of the most beautiful things. I probably seem completely unusual when people say that, and it's not because I'm unhappy with the interaction. I'm just like shocked personally that someone could feel about something that I've written the way that I feel about what other people write. And so, if anyone listening to this has ever done that, I've seen completely strange and bewildered. It's because I'm so sort of awed by the kindness of what you're saying to me.
Hey, there's an episode in the book where you meet Wei Sin Choi,
yes.
And you tell him what he meant to you and what the Jade Peony meant to you, and I can't remember how it goes now, but did you mention to him that you're thinking of writing a memoir?
This is such an imprinted moment in my life, because I can remember the room. I can remember so much of it. It was about maybe 5 or 6 years after I'd read The Jade Peony, but longer since it had been released, and I met him. But I knew, because he had published some other works since then, that he was an adopted individual, a queer adopted individual like myself. He was intra-racially adopted, so he learned about it later in life as those kinds of things, not that they should be, but can be hidden, more so than transracial adoption. But I told him, you know, I have these things in common with you. And I was a literary criticism student at the time. I was a decade away from even thinking about writing myself. But he said to me, you know, you should write this story, not knowing if I had any interest or skill or anything to do with writing. He told me that I should write that story. And I'll never forget it, because I've since learned how generous and how supportive Wei Sin Choi was to so many people. So I know that I'm not unique in that way. However, I've come to learn that his very trusted editor and many members of his team are exactly the same people who have been helping me along the way now.
Yeah. It's funny how these things work out, don't they? It's almost
it's
like fate, isn't
amazing.
It?
Yeah. It's as someone who has resisted these narratives of fate my whole life, it does make me want to be a believer, that's for sure.
And his warmth comes through. I never met him, but I interviewed him once for the show, and so we were on the phone like we are today. And I certainly understood what you were writing about in terms of that warmth and him spending that time and paying attention to you as he did.
Absolutely. And just, I mean, at the time, it was before I had reunited with my Korean family. And so I don't know if other transracially adopted people do this, but I would look to any Asian person that I was meeting at that time and wonder, like, you know, is my grandfather like this? Is my mother like this? And I remember feeling deep, at the very least, cultural kinship with him in that moment.
As I was reading the essay on language, I wondered what language you dream in.
I dream without language, I think, or at least without textual verbal language. I dream in images, but it's funny because people ask me that often. Do you dream in Korean? Do you dream in French? Do you dream in English? And having been asked that, I've come to realize that I largely philosophize and pontificate and I'm obnoxious in English. I express anger in French, and very specifically French Canadian, even more specifically Quebecois. And I express very visceral moments of pain in Korean. And those are the words that just sort of appear without thought.
Yeah. It's funny how primal sometimes our dreams are, aren't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. When one doesn't have a moment to deliberately curate these things or the capacity to, it's very interesting how these things come up.
I'm sure you get a lot of questions about polyamory. And you know, I finished, you know, the book, and the only question that I have really for you is because some people might think there's a connection between polyamory and adoption. In terms of your thinking and your experience, especially, there isn't, is there?
I don't think that there is for me. Absolutely not. I do think that in that particular essay that you're referring to in Rainbows, I link the two things. I link transracial adoption and polyamory, pansexuality, like queerness in general. In order, I think, to challenge liberal notions of, you know, accomplishment in some ways, or these symbols of accomplishment or fait accompli. You know, we have rainbow families, whether, and this term has been used to describe transracial adoption as well as queer kinship, of course, chosen family. I think my goal with that chapter is to say, you know, these things have happened. In many cases, it's not what has been intended that is the outcome. And we need to continue to critically engage with these issues and not, you know, pink wash or put a rainbow sticker on things and then say everything is solved. It's an invitation, that chapter, to always be striving for something more radical, more subversive, more contradictory, more challenging.
Yeah, I have to admit that I didn't know much about polyamory, or I might have had, you know, silly misconceptions about it. But after reading that essay, it made clear for me that, and like the book itself, it's really about love and being able to share love. And if you can do that with somebody else or other people, I mean, that can't be a bad thing if it's a healthy and constructive relationship, right?
I think so. I think that, you know, understanding that love and care can be multifarious is always a positive thing. One thing I don't really talk about too much in the book, but that I hope to think about more, is that polyamory is not necessarily antithetical to asexuality, that these kinds of dynamics don't necessarily mean exactly what on the surface they may appear to be.
Yeah, you actually say that in the book, that for you, it's been both a radical and ethical mode of survival. And I spent a lot of time thinking about that and working that in my head and seeing, you know, it obviously has worked, hasn't it, for you?
I mean, I don't think anything is ever completed or definitive, but I will say I have seen the ideological benefits and also the care benefits of all kinds of relationships.
There was another point that I wrote in my notes here that I want to just circle back to. You write that beauty is not exclusive from intelligence, and the importance, mm-hmm. you talk about the importance of beauty as self-care. And I think that's a point that we need to think about, because we do like to judge people when we see them. If we think about that, we probably would be less judgy, I guess, right?
Right. I mean, I don't mean to suggest we should be existing through vanity or like vacuous, you know, observations of one another or like hyper vigilance over these things. But the goal of that particular chapter that's called Pretty is to, in part, consider what it means to always have felt unpretty and how aesthetics can be used strategically, how celebrating the beauty of, you know, people of color and or indigenous people, of disabled people, of people of all ages is not necessarily as apolitical as some people would like us to believe. And in fact, it's also not an act of complete vanity or vapidness. It can very much be an act of strategic aesthetic acceptance and coping.
Yeah, I don't mean to equate this with hygiene, but I mean we wouldn't say denigrate someone for being hygienic, right? So why should we you know make light or look down at somebody who wants to you know fix himself up. I hate to use that term, but I can't think of a better one at the moment. So I just think if someone works at bettering themselves in any way, whatever way that might be, that can't be a bad thing.
Also, I mean, I want to add the caveat that this chapter is not a way of sidestepping or acknowledging the harms of things like pretty privilege,
harms of.
And I think that hopefully in that essay, I'm trying to work through a variety of perspectives on the issue. But, yeah, absolutely. It's not, in other words, it's not so easily sort of dismissed as only aesthetics. Aesthetics are a political act, in other words.
I mentioned the memoir earlier. and people's reaction to it that you're getting or you're reading online about it, say, I'm assuming that your writing has helped a lot of people. What is the process like for you? Do you get something out of it? I mean, in this collection, they're very raw, very painful moments that you write about. Does that help at all, the writing, say?
Reading it back helps a lot, I think, and thinking about things helps a lot. When I'm writing, I'm thinking very, very much in terms of craft. And perhaps sometimes maybe people might have a misunderstanding of memoir or nonfiction that it's just like, you know, I'm going to spill my guts about what I felt about this time. Mm-hmm. And I very much hope to dismantle that belief or, you know, that approach maybe doesn't work for everyone. I'm very much thinking about the strategies of craft, how to evoke certain affects from a reader, how to trigger certain patterns of remembering, all of these things. And just as fiction writers, just as poets, just as other kinds of artists do this, nonfiction writers do this as well. So that's where that comes in. The payoff, I think, really comes in the form of hopefully reflecting more on the space that I occupy and the relationships that I engage in, but also in I guess, communicating with and alongside and learning from readers.
I've kept you longer than I said I would, so I really appreciate your time today. I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed reading this book and talking to you today. Congratulations and good luck with this book, Jenny. Thanks for this.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
The book is called Everything and Nothing at All. It's author Jenny Heijoon-Wills. Join me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plato.